Chapter 10. Titan Reign. In 1789, an ambitious textile worker called Samuel Slater left England for a new life in the United States. Slater had risen to become a superintendent at a mill where a British inventor called Richard Arkwright was developing new techniques to use water power to drive machines, as well as to divide up tasks between his workers. Before he left, Slater memorized the design and workings of Arkwright's latest water mill. England had restricted the export of such know-how, and Slater had to lie and say he was a farmer. The year after he arrived in the New World, Slater worked with a Quaker merchant in Rhode Island to set up the first American water-powered cotton mill. It was such a success that Slater built up a town called Slatersville to service a growing New England factory system built in part on the understanding of mass production Slater had taken from home. The other great pioneer of the factory system at the time was Francis Cabot Lowell, who travelled from Boston to Britain for health reasons, but used the trip to tour every factory and memorize every detail. His bags were searched, but that did not matter, because he had everything in his head. Slater and Lowell's actions played an instrumental role in speeding up industrialization in America as it sought to catch up with Britain. Slater went down in his new country's folklore as the father of the American Industrial Revolution, a phrase coined by Andrew Jackson. In Britain, he had another name, Slater the Traitor, especially in the town whose workers suddenly felt the force of competition from an upstart rising power. Anyone who thinks Britain has a spotless record should pause to consider the case of Robert Fortune. Three-quarters of a century after Slater had done his work, Fortune was one of the few foreigners to trek deep into China. Fortune was a botanist and gardener, but also an industrial spy. His mission was to steal a Chinese secret that Britain desperately coveted. Its tea. The tea plants of China were known to be the finest in the world. A few years before Fortune set out in the late 1840s, Britain had dispatched the Royal Navy to bully China to sell its tea in return for receiving opium. The resulting short, sharp war even won Britain the useful island of Hong Kong as a colony. China jealously guarded its precious tea secrets, but after years of effort and some danger, Fortune, employed by the British East India Company, managed to smuggle out thousands of tea plants and seeds, as well as the know-how about growing them. This was all taken to Darjeeling in British Imperial India. In a few years, Darjeeling tea was being sold on the global market in much larger quantities and more cheaply than the Chinese tea that had once been so prized. The Chinese tea industry was never the same again. Call it what you will, intellectual property theft, commercial or industrial espionage, or just plain old spying, but stealing business secrets from the competition is not new. It has a pedigree through the ages. As with other forms of espionage, computers have allowed something old to be done in new ways. Initially, computers were the targets of commercial espionage rather than the medium through which it took place. The Soviet Union had long sought Western computer know-how, as the Farewell case showed. By the 1980s, as now, the threat of high-tech espionage was seen as coming from an Asian power whose economy was predicted to eclipse that of the West. In 1982, a joint FBI and IBM team set up a fake consulting company. It was supposed to ensnare Soviet spies seeking high-tech equipment. "We had always assumed that we would be busting foreigners with Russian accents," one FBI official later recalled. "I guess we never figured that we would be busting Japanese businessmen." A group of executives from Hitachi were snared after stuffing confidential information about disk drives into golf bags. This was corporate espionage, one company spying on another. Japan's intelligence service was suspected of working closely with its companies on a vast program to steal secrets from the car industry and high-tech sectors like computing. But then Japan's economy went into decline and attention moved on. The other nation that upset the US around the same time was France. Its intelligence service was said to be targeting high-tech computer companies like IBM and Texas Instruments in the late 1980s, recruiting agents and then passing information to French competitors. One story has it that a French agent inside IBM was unmasked when he drunkenly told an American friend what he was doing. Through the early 1990s, U.S. officials, including the Secretary of State and head of the CIA, told France to dial it down. Congress started to ask U.S. intelligence officials, "Shouldn't we do this commercial espionage thing too?" The response of the Clinton administration, according to officials who served at the time, was to ask, "Whom do you want us to support?" In other words, which companies would receive the stolen information? One of the obvious but often overlooked aspects of state-led industrial espionage is that it requires an industrial policy that the espionage is supporting. This is more straightforward in countries with state-owned enterprises in which the line between the state and the company is relatively porous. It can also apply when certain private sector companies are designated as national champions, making it possible for them to be directly supported by the intelligence agencies. In the early 1990s, Anglo-Iranian Oil, now BP, was helped out when MI6 and the CIA overthrew a democratically elected Iranian government because it nationalized the Iranian side of the business. But as time went on, in the British and American free market economies, national champions became less obvious as companies grew more globalized and as competition ensured multiple players. This meant, former intelligence officials say, that while the odd bit of useful intelligence might have been passed on from spy to company, there was never any wholesale official policy or formal channel of spying to support corporations. The 1980s and 1990s saw industrial espionage targeting information about computers, as the KGB had done extensively in the Cold War. But it was not using computer networks themselves as the means of stealing the information. Rather, it still used people, who were often bribed to carry out documents. It was only a matter of time, though, before corporate espionage and computer hacking would meet. Computers made espionage easy, cheap, and low risk. Now there was no need to hand over the IBM disk drive in a hotel room and then fly it over to Asia while worrying about the FBI busting through the door. You could do the whole thing over the internet. As spies were dismissed with the end of the Cold War, corporate espionage took off. Intelligence was becoming privatized, with consultants offering due diligence and business intelligence, which they would sometimes use as a cover to steal secrets for their clients. The private sector began to spy and to hack, but so did states. And the big, but not the only, player would be a new entrant into the world of electronic espionage, taking the work of men like Samuel Slater into the 21st century, and paying back the West for Robert Fortune's tea smuggling. A local employee in Britain was a little bit curious about why a senior executive in his company was showing interest in what he was doing. The employee worked in the local office of the Canadian telecoms company Nortel. Its roots went back to the 19th century era of building the telegraph cable system, and by the start of the 21st century, it was one of the big players in building modern communications infrastructure. At its peak, Nortel employed 90,000 people worldwide and made up around a third of the entire value of the Toronto Stock Exchange. In 2004, the British employee noticed that an executive vice president of the company seemed to be downloading from the corporate network a lot of documents that he had been working on. It was not clear exactly why. So he thought he would send an email to the executive and see if he had any questions about his material and if he could help out. The executive responded tersely, "I don't know what you're talking about," saying he had not pulled off any of the British employees' documents from the computer network. Brian Shields from the IT security team was asked to look into it. He could see that in the first 6 months of 2004 alone, over 1,500 documents were taken out using 7 different accounts belonging to Nortel executives. These were not any old executives. The greatest number of documents had been taken out using the account of the company's chief executive. The central security team had not noticed anything wrong until the British employee had asked his question. "Nobody detected it," says Shields. When he started going back through the logs of activity, Shields could see it was not new. There were traces as far back as 2000, as long as the logs had been in existence. The executives were in Canada, but the logs showed the documents were going back to internet addresses in China, mostly in the Beijing area, but also Shanghai. There was no picking and choosing. It was like a lorry turning up outside in the middle of the night, copying every document in sight, and then driving off. Since Nortel was a Canadian company, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police were informed. They asked for all the reports and information. "We got nothing back," says Shields. He believes the authorities did not understand what was happening or know what to do. The attackers had almost certainly used the fact that Nortel had very poor security when employees logged into the system remotely, say from their home computers. All you needed to get in was a username and password. There was no need for what was known as two-factor authentication, the addition of a second password. This might be a constantly changing number randomly generated by a key fob you would carry around, often supplied by the company RSA, which had been founded by Rivest, Edelman, and Shamir, which would then be added to your own password and matched by your corporate network in a form of modern encryption. Shields asked one person involved in the security of the firm for his impressions. "We are the antithesis of security," that person told him. "We did nothing from a security standpoint to keep them out," says Shields. "I don't consider resetting 7 high-level employee passwords as taking any real action." Nortel had been trying to get into the growing Chinese market from the late 1990s, seeing it as the next great sales opportunity to drive growth. Chinese rules meant that required setting up manufacturing and software coding operations in the country as a joint venture. This was a deliberate Chinese strategy to bring in as much technology as possible. The concern over espionage became apparent from when Nortel went into a joint venture in the 1990s. One person thought the faxes were being monitored during the negotiations, which meant the Chinese could negotiate down the deal until it reached Nortel's bottom line and minimum position. Shields was also advised by colleagues from other countries that luggage would be searched and laptops examined in hotel rooms. Shields knew all about the Chinese threat because he was also part of a group that received classified briefings from government. The Network Security Information Exchange brought together the government and the private sector. In the early 2000s, this group began to put together the pieces of what was happening in cyberspace and realized something serious was going on. On the corporate side, representatives of sensitive companies in fields like defense and telecoms took part, the likes of Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Cisco, and AT&T, but also UK companies like British Telecom. From the government side were a string of people from the three-letter agencies, FBI, CIA, NSA, and the like, but also Britain's CPNI, the Centre for the Protection of National Infrastructure, linked to MI5. The group would meet in Washington every other month for a day and a half to share their knowledge of security threats. Those discussions remain classified, But there is little doubt that what came up was the emergence of a large-scale and sophisticated Chinese threat. Government intelligence agencies knew a lot more than they could say. They wanted industry to understand there was a problem, but they did not want to reveal everything. If they did, then in classic spy versus spy fashion, it would tip off the Chinese to what they knew about them and induce them to change their behavior so that they could no longer be watched. What were they stealing from Nortel? Research and development information, pricing information, sales plans, customer information, new features, planned enhancements. Every type of business information. It was priceless to a competitor. They had untethered access to it all, Shields says. It is the Chinese stealing the technology, making it for less, selling it at cutthroat prices, and hands down winning bids where they compete with Nortel for business. Shields wrote to his CEO, "How can you survive when you have information about your intimate goings-on being turned over to competitors?" he asked. Proving that the material was stolen is easy. Proving it went to China is harder, but possible, even if not definitively. But proving who received it in China and what they might have done with it, that is almost impossible. At the time, Nortel was losing out in bids against a new Chinese company on the rise. Nortel was coming in at nearly 50% more costly to do the same work as the Chinese firm Huawei. However, there is no evidence to prove any connection between Huawei's rise and the hacking. Correlating one company's demise with another's rise and attributing that to cyber espionage is almost impossible. And Shields does not believe that Huawei itself was attacking Nortel. The attackers were high-end and stealthy. "Are average hackers going to be that good?" asks Shields rhetorically. "No, I don't think so. People that are pros are doing this." He believed the Chinese state was responsible. "This isn't fair," says Shields, arguing that the power of a state targeting a company is immoral. "It is not a level playing field." Shields wrote reports on the problem, but he believes they never reached the board or the company's new chief executive. Shields's view was that those immediately above him did not want to own up and tell the world what had happened because investors would lose confidence and the stock price would tank. His proposed solution was severe. Close off people doing sensitive research and development. No internet access, laptops and the like, so that you air-gap your systems like intelligence agencies. Make your opponent go back to having to break in or recruit a human spy. That kind of attack is much harder and more costly to do. Right now, they can do this in a nice cozy room over there in China as they laugh at how easy it is to take from us what we have worked so hard to make, he wrote to the CEO. But such advice went against the overwhelming trend in business to move everything online and connect it up all the time. That, of course, made everyone and everything vulnerable all the time. Nortel's business was starting to fall apart as it struggled to compete and pay its debts. Cuts in the workforce took their toll. Shields was one of those laid off. He then spent 2 weeks drafting a 15-page letter to the chief executive. "Let me begin by telling you I am certain the Chinese are inside Nortel's network," he wrote. "They have free rein to take whatever they want and have for a long time. I firmly believe it is the unfair Chinese competition that is running this company out of existence." But by then, it was already too late. In January 2009, Nortel, a company which could trace its origins back to the late 19th century, filed for bankruptcy. What was left of the business was sold off in pieces, leaving only arguments over the amount executives paid out in the final years compared to what little was left in the pension fund. Why did it collapse? Shields believes cyber espionage was the pivotal reason. "I personally think it ran the company into the ground. It ran them out of business," he argues of the collapse. I think it was mostly because of the cyber espionage. Can that really be true? In reality, it is impossible to be sure about the relative role played by industrial cyber espionage. Wider problems plagued Nortel, and a major study found that the company failed because of dozens of issues over a long period. Among them was sharper competition from rivals, against which Nortel failed to adapt. Some of that competition was American, notably Cisco, who were developing better products. Some of that foreign competition came from China. Chinese businesses would maintain they succeeded by driving down costs rather than stealing business plans. And so the question that dominates discussion about Chinese corporate cyber espionage remains: how do you prove what is being done? Britain and America have a fairly set idea of what espionage consists of. This, at least in terms of popular culture, comes from watching James Bond films and reading Jean Le Carré. Espionage involves professional spies doing dangerous and duplicitous things in shady places. But espionage and intelligence are not concepts fixed in stone, and it is a mistake when trying to grasp Chinese cyber espionage to attempt to make it conform to a world it does not inhabit. China operates its own unique system in which what the West thinks of as traditional espionage plays only a partial role. The modern Chinese Communist Party has three strategic goals: maintain social stability, defend the country and its interests, and become a regional and ultimately global power. Maintaining a frenetic pace of economic growth is an imperative for all three. Growth is essential to project power and influence abroad, but also to satisfy the growing middle class at home, and in so doing, maintain the legitimacy of rule by the Communist Party elite and avoid questions about the lack of democracy. As it came out of the dark period of the Cultural Revolution, China in 1978 adopted a policy of four modernizations, with an aim of turning the country into a world power by the 21st century. In March 1986, a program was launched which aimed to end what was seen as a century of humiliation by foreign powers, Britain and the Opium Wars, Japan more recently, by using technology to leapfrog into the future and over other countries. This meant engaging with the outside world overtly and covertly. Sustaining growth over the long term can be difficult, especially once the easy work has been done and you aspire to move up the value chain. Making cheap things cheaper than everyone else only gets you so far. China needed to innovate. And what if, at the same time as you realize this, it becomes easier to get hold of others' innovation by penetrating their computer systems and obtaining their intellectual property? China was also determined from around 2000 to become an advanced information society using the application of technology to modernize. So cyber espionage offered a tool for state policy to support modernization, growth, military power, and independence. One way of understanding Chinese espionage is the thousand grains of sand model. In this account, three different countries want to know what kind of sand is on a beach in a foreign country. One country, let's call it Britain, would send a submarine to the vicinity and then a commando team, probably wearing black tie underneath their wetsuits, to get a sample in the dead of night. Another country, let's call it America, might use the latest technology by pointing their satellites to stare down at the beach and sending sniffer planes to collect samples from the air. A third country, let's call it China, would do things differently. It would send thousands of its own citizens to take a holiday on the beach. And, as one writer puts it, at sunset they would all go home and simply shake out their towels, and the Chinese would end up with more sand and more data than other nations. This is also known as the vacuum cleaner approach. use a mass of people to suck up literally everything you can, rather than the surgical approach, supposedly favoured by both Western and Russian intelligence, in which you pinpoint the one or two hard-to-get secrets that you're really after and focus your efforts on those. Critics have suggested that this picture is too crude and that China uses traditional espionage methods as well. In practice, it pursues a more layered approach, ranging from the vacuum cleaner to the surgical operation. This, it is said, also fits with the lack of a clear distinction between intelligence and information in China. We think of intelligence as meaning secret intelligence and involving spies, as distinct from information, unprocessed data that is not secret. One Western lawyer says the danger is the poisoned umbrella fallacy that spying always involves danger and death. Spying in Western countries is a specialized professional discipline which is kept as secret as possible. In China, the distinction between intelligence and information is less clearly defined. This creates an ambiguity that is useful, as China built a system to gather information from abroad, often involving its own citizens, as distinct from the Western and Russian model of engaging or blackmailing locals in your target country. When a Chinese person abroad is asked to get hold of something, they might be told that this is useful for China, but they would not think of themselves as a spy. There were many ways to make such requests, from playing on patriotism to more direct forms of pressure on family back home, depending on the situation. There are also the vast numbers of Chinese students coming to the West, especially in engineering and scientific disciplines. The quiet ones at the back, says one Western intelligence official. These are not spies. They have come to learn. There is nothing illegal in what they do, but they are all part of the plan to absorb as much as possible, which includes making use of academic research publications, product samples, patent documents, and technical journals, so-called open-source intelligence. When it comes to technology, you do not always have to steal it by going abroad. You can persuade someone to come to you and hand it over. China did this around the turn of the millennium by encouraging foreign firms to set up research and development labs there with the promise of access to the vast and growing Chinese market. In return, they needed to share their technological know-how. Among those who took this path were high-tech companies like Microsoft, IBM, Nortel, Siemens, and Motorola. Access to the Chinese market was worth any minimal risk, they thought. This played a part in the wider Chinese strategy of acquiring technology and then adapting it in a distinctly Chinese way. Western counterintelligence or spycatching services, like Britain's MI5 and America's FBI, were geared up to spot the tiny traces of a Soviet agent operating under deep cover. This meant they had no idea how to deal with large-scale Chinese espionage when they first saw it, leading to much confusion. In the late 1990s, anxieties surfaced amid fears that top-secret nuclear weapon designs had been stolen from U.S. nuclear laboratories. A secret report in 1998 warned of an acute intelligence threat to nuclear weapons labs as it emerged that their unclassified computer systems had been penetrated 324 times in a matter of months. The few cyber investigators in government were pulled away from Moonlight Maze and towards Chinese targets. But the potential for cyber espionage was not yet understood, so the real concern remained about people with Asian backgrounds working with security clearances. This led to the ill-fated pursuit of Wenho Li, an ethnic Chinese scientist at Los Alamos Laboratories, wrongly accused of leaking nuclear secrets in the late 1990s and later cleared. The collapse of that case, followed by the 11th of September 2001 attacks, put the issue on the back burner, but it did not go away. By the turn of the new century, China had woken up to the possibilities of computer-based espionage, employing it alongside other techniques like academic and commercial solicitation rather than instead of them. Many countries and companies conduct commercial espionage. What is different about China? The simple answer is scale. China has attempted computer-based commercial espionage on a transformative scale. One American writer rejects the comparison with the way his country stole British technology in the past. In a manner of speaking, the United States stole books. China steals libraries. In industrial espionage, as in other ways, computers allowed a scaling up which changed the game. It made it easier to do and harder to get caught. The first traces of sustained Chinese cyber espionage were spotted around the turn of the century. The targets were primarily defense and high-tech companies of the so-called defense industrial base, to harness their intellectual property and technological know-how, not so much for the benefit of Chinese companies as to be able to understand American military expertise and build Chinese versions of those systems. The reality of Chinese penetration was sometimes met with denial, even within the most sensitive places that were targeted. People did not want to own up to the fact that they had been taken to the cleaners. The politics and secrecy surrounding intrusions could spell trouble for individuals. When he was still a student, Sean Carpenter was drawn into the world of computer security by Cliff Stoll's book, The Cuckoo's Egg, which detailed the investigation of the KGB-linked Hanover hackers. But his own experience of tracking hackers would get Carpenter into deeper water than Stoll. In May 2004, as a computer intrusion expert at Sandia National Laboratories, which dealt with America's nuclear arsenal, Carpenter began investigating a breach he had spotted in the Sandia system. He had already seen similar attacks a few months earlier on Lockheed Martin's network, the defense giant which ran the labs under a contract, and so he knew that whoever was behind it was particularly good, grabbing what they wanted in a matter of minutes, leaving almost no fingerprints, but keeping a back door open so they could return later. Carpenter had become adept at using a technique called backhacking to find out who was behind breaches and what they had taken, pursuing the attackers up into their networks. This was something he had used in the past to retrieve passwords and other sensitive data. It meant following the person who burgled you and perhaps stealing your possessions back off them. Carpenter pursued the attackers online through the places where they stashed their stolen files in Hong Kong, Taiwan, and South Korea, to what he believed was their source, Guangdong, in southern China. Carpenter installed code on the last hop router in Guangdong where the attacks were coming from. Every time the group was active and the router connected, an email would be sent to an account he set up. When he looked at the account after 2 weeks, there were 23,000 messages. This was much more than one individual. It was a team working all hours. Carpenter's dogged investigative work turned up a large cache of stolen, sensitive documents, many defense-related, hidden on a server in South Korea. Among the documents were hundreds of pages of detailed schematics and project information marked Lockheed Martin Proprietary Information Export Controlled, linked to the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter being built for NASA. Carpenter went to see his superiors. "I was told it was not my concern," he recalled a few years later. "I attempted several times to find a Sandia channel to get the information to the organizations that were impacted, but Sandia supervisors told him not to. They said they only cared about Sandia computers." Carpenter said that there surely had to be a way of sharing the information about what had happened with federal and military authorities. He was told it was not his job. The reason may have been that Sandia feared talking to others would bring unwelcome scrutiny on Sandia, particularly regarding the methods by which the data had been obtained, including backhacking. The fact that the data had been lost would also not look good for Lockheed, who managed the lab. Questions would be asked about their security procedures. It was a case of putting the interests of the corporation before those of the country, Carpenter believed. So he alerted contacts in the U.S. Army Research Laboratory. Because of their rules about working with civilians, he ended up talking to the FBI. Things began to get complicated. They were very interested, as they were already investigating a set of breaches, so began using him as a confidential informant as he continued to peer into the computers launching the attacks. Carpenter had found a stunning trail of evidence, but at the same time his work might be questionable under U.S. law because he had hacked foreign computers to find out the information. Carpenter had been using techniques that his office had approved in the past, but this time the rabbit hole he had gone down was much deeper than he had imagined. In January 2005, Carpenter was summoned to a meeting with Sandia management, who had been informed of his work with the FBI. He was told his investigations were an inappropriate use of confidential information gained from his employment, and that he would be stripped of his Q clearance, which allowed him to work there. Carpenter recalls that a senior security official who had previously worked for the CIA yelled at him, "You're lucky you have such understanding management. If you worked for me, I would decapitate you. There would at least be blood all over the office." Shortly after that meeting, Carpenter's boss showed up at his office. He took away his badge and escorted him to the gate. Carpenter went on successfully to sue Sandia for wrongful termination. Carpenter had been exposed to the toxic brew that was Titan Rain, the single most significant cyber espionage campaign in history. Titan Rain was causing real alarm within the military by 2003, with hundreds of Defense Department systems penetrated, according to a government alert that November. Titan Rain is thought to have stolen terabytes of data from Sandia Labs, NASA, and U.S. defense contractors by 2004, 10 to 20 terabytes by 2007. 2 years later, not just the U.S., but its allies too were aware that something significant was going on, with the other members of the Five Eyes Club of Western powers issuing their own warnings that summer. These electronic attacks have been underway for a significant period of time, with a recent increase in sophistication, Britain's National Infrastructure Security Coordination Centre warned in June 2005. The centre said that nearly 300 critical businesses and government departments in the UK had been targeted. Titan Rain began by going for the most sensitive industries, those in defence, telecoms and related to national security, as well as government systems. A leading target was the Joint Strike Fighter F-35 Lightning II, with terabytes of data stolen, including radar design and engine schematics. The high-tech plane, which relies on 7.5 million lines of code to fly, was built jointly by contractors, but with Lockheed Martin leading the project. The company was first targeted in 2003 as part of Titan Rain, reports said. The total investment from design to maintenance of the plane is estimated at a staggering $1 trillion. This was the modern computer-based equivalent of the theft of defense secrets that the KGB had undertaken in the Cold War, and which other countries have also utilized. Britain's BAE had also reportedly been hit as part of the campaign to steal F-35 secrets. This happened in 2007 to 2008, according to reports of what a BAE executive said during a private dinner. The company declined to comment about those reports at the time. One American said that there was not a defense contractor that had not been penetrated. Attacks became more sophisticated as defenses improved, going through weak links in the supply chain as the years progressed. The attacks also began to use more innovative techniques, targeting RSA, which provided secure authentication devices for staff at defense contractors to log onto their networks. Once the Titan Rain codename was revealed, it was changed to Byzantine Hades and has been changed again since. The more they looked for, the more investigators found. There were at least 500 significant intrusions into the military itself, with 600,000 user accounts compromised and an estimated $100 million in costs to assess damage and rebuild networks, according to a once top-secret document. Not just the F-35, but also other planes, space-based lasers, missile navigation, and nuclear submarines had their designs taken. New subsets were identified. Byzantine Candor initially targeted the U.S. Army and later the rest of the military, as well as events like oil deals with sophisticated emails which, when opened, would install software that logged keystrokes to allow massive amounts of data to be taken out. Since at least March 2008, these hackers, who were linked to the PLA, People's Liberation Army, 3rd Department in Shanghai, compromised a U.S. internet service provider so that they could use it to steal a complete list of usernames and passwords from a U.S. government network. A plethora of further Byzantine subsets emerged in the following years, with codenames like Raptor, Anchor, Viking, Trace, Prairie, and Foothold. Hacking had moved to a world far away from Cliff Stoll watching Hanover Druggies, as from around 2005, cyber espionage went beyond national security-related fields into the wider corporate space. In the days of Cliff Stoll and Rome Labs, it had been about vulnerabilities in the operating systems of computers, the way they were built. They often had open ports to the outside world, no firewalls to control access, and poor passwords. Stoll himself had pondered that one of the inhibitors to the hackers then had been that they came across different operating systems against which the techniques they used did not work. In the late 1990s, that changed. A single operating system emerged, Microsoft Windows, that almost everyone used. That had come at the moment e-commerce was just beginning and opened the way for a cascade of criminal hacking that exploited the myriad vulnerabilities in the ocean of code that made up the Microsoft system. By the early 2000s, Microsoft had woken up as hackers voraciously exploited its flaws and sent out viruses like Code Red, latter-day versions of the Morris worm, which crashed websites around the world and gave the company a bad reputation. Microsoft didn't even know how to spell security, says one former British intelligence official of the company at that time. Bill Gates realized the company was standing on a burning platform that hackers were setting alight. This led to a famous January 2002 memo from Gates to all his staff prioritizing what was called trustworthy computing over the following 10 years. The vulnerabilities in platforms were slowly being addressed and patches were being issued to close them. But as that shell was hardened, the adversaries found a new way in, targeting the humans who worked behind the shell. All they had to do was find one person to let them in so they could roam free. They would conduct campaigns that were stealthy, persistent, and advanced, running over long periods. These campaigns became known as Advanced Persistent Threats, or APTs, advanced because of their sophistication and persistent because of their patience. Countries had spent years perfecting the equivalents of radars to spot anything entering their cyberspace, but APTs were like stealth fighters flying underneath the radar. They did this by persuading a user to click on a link, thereby effectively inviting the enemy into your airspace and making it look like a friendly signal on your system rather than that of a foe. A phishing attack was a generic email sent out in the hope someone would click, The next technique would be spear phishing, a targeted email directed at one person and written in such a way as to make them think it was safe. Old-school espionage involved breaking into a company in person, or perhaps persuading an employee to sneak out some files. Modern cyber espionage has adapted that process for the digital age. A modern espionage heist is a carefully planned operation. The first step is finding someone who works at the office and winning their trust, perhaps by posing as a colleague. Drop in a word about an upcoming conference you know they are attending, perhaps. If the first person you try is a bit suspicious, then keep going around the office until you find the one person who is too tired or busy or is just a bit sloppy and clicks on that attachment to the email you send. This allows you to do the equivalent of walking through the security gate behind them or borrowing their pass. Once they have let you in through the door, you can make your own copy of the key so that you can come and go at will at night without the guards, cameras, or gates thinking anything of it. Perhaps, once you have this, you might hand the key over to a colleague. You might have had the social skills and the language skills to persuade the employer to let you inside, but your colleague is much better at rooting around the office and looking for things without drawing attention to himself, while you find your next target. No need for this person to rush. Perhaps spend a few months getting the layout of the building and working out where everything is. Perhaps working out how to get into some of the more secure safes in some people's offices. They will also have a list of what they have been told to look for. Finally, when they are ready, they might hand over to a third person. He or she is the muscle. They know how to lift the material fast and move it out. This is the most dangerous moment for the burglar, since the security cameras may notice someone walking out in the middle of the night with so much stuff. But the package can be deposited at a safe house nearby that your employer rented. This is a staging post, so that just in case you were followed, the trail will not lead back to your organization. But once the package is there, it can be shipped overseas via some unusual route, to a controller in Shanghai, or Beijing, or perhaps Moscow, Tel Aviv, Maryland, or even Cheltenham. Job done. And, of course, the beauty of this system, compared to a normal heist, is that you are never even physically in the building itself. It is all done remotely, and you are copying rather than taking the data. If you are lucky, no one will ever even know you were there. Mandiant, founded by Kevin Mandia, veteran of the U.S. Air Force investigations of the 1990s, saw the first signs of wider corporate interests being targeted from 2004, but activity really picked up a few years later. The company tracked one particular virulent group dubbed APT-1, finding its fingerprints in attacks against 141 companies, largely in the English-speaking world, dating back to at least 2006. Once they got inside a network, the hackers at APT-1 stayed there for an average of 356 days, but in one case they were allowed to roam for a remarkable 4 years and 10 months. One organization alone had 6.5 terabytes of data stolen over 10 months. APT-1 became the poster boy of Chinese cyber espionage teams, but was only one of 25 or so groups seen as operating out of the country, and achieved notoriety because of its focus on English-speaking targets. Companies are loath to admit they have been breached. Boards know that an admission may cost in terms of share price, and perhaps in their jobs. And the cost to the business of intellectual property theft may not become apparent for years, if at all. By then, the board members will almost certainly have moved on. What was stolen? Huge amounts of intellectual property, research and innovation, product designs, and the like. Western experts started talking about heavily protected research institutes appearing in Chinese cities, and the companies linked to them suddenly making huge leaps forward. Intellectual property had always had a more elastic definition in China, think pirated DVDs and computer software, but espionage allowed it to be done to a company's most precious secrets. A new drug or aircraft engine design might have taken years of work and cost millions in research, but all the work could be siphoned off in a few moments. High-tech industries in fields like clean energy, biotech, pharmaceuticals, and new materials were all top targets, companies whose value increasingly resided in the ones and zeros of what they knew, whether research or customer data, which, in turn, was vulnerable. The greatest transfer of wealth in history is how the then NSA Director General Keith Alexander described cyber espionage in 2012. Some of the language of Western officials about the damage from intellectual property theft has bordered on the apocalyptic. People have proposed extraordinary figures, hundreds of billions or even $1 trillion of damage. But is that right? It may well be the greatest transfer of information in history, but has that extended to the actual transfer of real wealth? Ask the prophets of doom to cite specific cases where the theft of intellectual property has done material damage, and they often pause. Information and intellectual property may have been stolen on a massive scale. This seems indisputable. But how often has that stolen data actually been used to build something that has disadvantaged the original owner? An executive from one very well-known British brand says that even if its highly advanced engineering designs have been stolen by the Chinese, he doubts they have the ability actually to build what is contained in those designs. There may be a lag time between acquiring such data and using it, though. It may take 5 years or maybe 10 to be sure what the long-term consequences are. We simply do not know at the moment. When pressed to be precise about damage, one area Western experts cite is the defense industry. This belongs much more to the ancient tradition of spies targeting defense secrets so as to replicate a weapons design or understand potential vulnerabilities. U.S. experts point to the fact that the Chinese achieved the advanced skill of making a submarine move quietly far faster than the U.S. or Russia. The other example they point to is the J-20 Chinese stealth aircraft. Again, it seems China was able to develop the technology far faster than anyone expected. The new plane arrived around a decade after Chinese hackers, likely as part of the Titan Rain campaign, broke into a U.S. facility called, ironically, China Lake, which is one of the premier research grounds for stealth. However, they may also have got some of the technology from a U.S. aircraft shot down by Serbia in 1999. As is often the case, it is hard to be sure of the exact role of any cyber component. When Coca-Cola was negotiating the multi-billion-dollar purchase of a Chinese company, the APT1 group is reported to have got hold of their negotiating strategy. The bid failed. Another campaign by a different group called Night Dragon is reported to have targeted oil and gas companies like BP, Shell, and Exxon. The thieves appear to have taken highly valuable geological data about where possible gas and oil reserves might lie, which may have been worth hundreds of millions of dollars, as it could allow a competitor to try to move in. This is the other side of commercial cyber espionage. Stealing not intellectual property, but business-sensitive information. It might relate to contracts, mergers and acquisitions, or bids. China is hungry for natural resources, and mining is one industry that is believed to have been hit hard over contract negotiations. Companies trying to buy up a copper mine in the Congo might find themselves losing out, but not realizing they had been outbid by a fraction based on inside knowledge. These campaigns are often seen as state-sponsored. Why? It is partly based on what was being stolen. If you are burgled and thieves leave behind the expensive jewellery but take some notebooks, then you know that it was not an ordinary burglary. Modern cyber burglars were not taking information which could be monetized easily, for instance, people's financial information, like credit card details. That suggested another motive. However skillful they are, digital burglars also leave fingerprints, not real ones, but telltale signs you can see after they have broken in. How did they do it? How much reconnaissance did they do? How careful were they? How long did they stick around for? What kinds of things were they after? Anything they could get their hands on or specific items? And, perhaps most telling, what tools or types of code did they use to get in? By examining these over time, you can get a pretty good sense of when you are seeing the same person, or more likely, someone from the same team, breaking into different properties. Some of the signs were obvious. Western cybersecurity analysts noticed the people they were tracking almost always worked office hours, China time, and not national holidays in China. That, of course, could be faked, but the evidence was mounting. In February 2013, Mandiant went public and issued a report saying it believed APT-1 was in fact Unit 61398 of the Chinese PLA. Mandiant had responded to 141 companies, Kevin Mandia explains, every time the technical and anecdotal evidence took us to Shanghai. The evidence was enough to trace the attacks to a door in a down-at-heel part of the city that housed Unit 61398, if not quite inside the building itself. The 12-story high facility had a special fiber-optic infrastructure built by China Telecom. The hackers used Chinese-language keyboard settings, and their IP addresses were located in Shanghai. Resumes linked to Unit 61398 also match the skill set of hackers doing this kind of work. Some of the hackers could be identified when they made mistakes and let their guard down. They had hacker names like Ugly Gorilla. This was hacking quite literally on an industrial scale with hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people working in a 130,000 square foot building with considerable infrastructure and logistics behind it. Cyber espionage had begun with teenagers in their bedrooms in Hanover or in Colindale. Now it was done in specially built factories which even had a children's nursery attached. Downloading material en masse would take forever on a dial-up modem, not in the broadband age of fast connections in which data could be downloaded in a moment. This was one of a number of developments that took industrial hacking to an industrial scale. It included a clear division of labor, a factory system like the one Samuel Slater had passed on to America. Foot soldiers would do the grunt work, but if they came up against a tricky problem in getting into a system, they might refer upwards to a more senior expert. Conditions for the workers reflected the huge scale on which electronic hacking was now being done. In some ways, they were like those of the British workers at postal and cable censorship offices in days gone by, working laboriously through message after message. One blog posting by a 25-year-old from Unit PLA 61398 described a world of long hours, low pay and boredom. Hours were normally 8 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., but could be longer. He wore a uniform but lived in a dorm and had little time for a real social life other than watching TV and surfing the internet. "Fate has made me feel imprisoned," he wrote as he designed viruses to perform specific functions like copying files off a USB device attached to a computer. "I want to escape." He worked to targets, and if he met them, would get an end-of-year bonus, but moaned about his boss making the most of expenses while he was told off for claiming the cost of a bus ticket. Life did not sound very glamorous, and eventually he seemed to have given up and got out. Western intelligence analysts spent a long time trying to look for a controlling mind in Beijing behind all these disparate espionage campaigns. But the reality is that there may not be one. Groups may have sponsors higher up the political chain, or they may be relatively independent. Some are tightly woven into military intelligence and operating to a clear strategy. Some Western analysts can track their work in direct correlation to the latest 5-year plan from China, working to a requirements list, just as British spies do. But the same group might still do a bit of freelance work for themselves, or for Chinese companies, on the side. It can be hard to figure out where the lines between state and purely commercial action lie. That may be because there is no clear line. China is much more fragmented bureaucratically and internally than is often portrayed in the West, where it is often seen as monolithic. Its defense industry is even poorly coordinated in terms of research, development, and spending, and riven by a lack of communication and compartmentalization. Chinese cyber espionage may be far more opportunistic and chaotic than is sometimes portrayed. Competition means different groups may end up going after the same targets, tripping over each other inside Western companies. One aspect, rarely commented on in the West, is the degree of economic cyber espionage that goes on within China. This involves Chinese hacking other Chinese firms to gain advantage. One cyber expert who has traveled to China frequently says that hacking is so endemic that it goes even further. He says that the Shanghai office of a company will even be found hacking the Beijing office of the same company as they compete for sales targets and managers seek advantage and promotion. It is not unheard of either for Western companies to carry out commercial espionage against each other. In the West, boardrooms are regularly swept for bugs, and it is not just the Chinese that they are worried about. Corporate cyber espionage has, like the rest of hacking, become increasingly easy to do. And it has been not just industrialized, but commoditized and commercialized too. Hackers, having had to find and exploit vulnerabilities themselves, now sell the tools so that anyone with relatively little training can spy. Or, if you still prefer a proper hacker to do it, websites advertise access to corporate networks with fees on a per-hour basis, the burglar acting to order. China is certainly not the only player in town, but it is the most brazen. For 20 years, Western companies turned the other way, believing that tolerating a bit of spying was a price worth paying for access to the Chinese market. "We can innovate faster than they can steal," was the thinking. As China grew and grew and began to innovate itself more and more, that argument was heard less and less. Corporate America was beginning to have had enough. Concern over Chinese spying finally reached the highest levels of government when it got personal for senior officials. In June 2007, an email system from the office of the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, used by his policy advisers, was penetrated. The Pentagon shut down more than 1,500 computers for a week to try and contain it once they were in. Officials at the time said they were highly confident the PLA was responsible. The Pentagon began to push for action. The FBI told both the McCain and Obama presidential election campaigns that their networks had been infiltrated, apparently by the same group. Obama later said that from August to October 2008, someone had got into emails, campaign plans ranging from policy positions to travel plans. There are significant compromises in that 2007 to 2009 period, William Lin, former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense, says of the defense industry. "China? They are sucking our brains out every day," is the way a retired American general put the problem. At the tail end of the Bush administration, there was a debate as to whether or not to call the Chinese out in public. Hank Paulson, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, resisted, and President Bush trusted his judgment. The concern was partly over the potential impact if China fought back economically, and also the problem that much of the material was classified. Slowly, national security officials began to talk about the issue, not least to try to get executives of companies to take it seriously. The debate as to whether to go public or not continued under President Obama. In 2013, when Mandiant accused Unit 61398 of the PLA of being APT-1, it did not make its move without consulting the government. The White House was briefed on the plan. This, according to those involved, helped confirm the facts, but also provided the nod to go ahead and publish. The White House had been looking at a range of methods of putting pressure on Beijing, from public shaming to legal charges, and even discussed cutting off the bank accounts of those involved, especially those who had children in school in the U.S. A big showdown was planned between President Obama and the Chinese leader in the summer of 2013. Mandiant's outing of Unit 61398 was one of the ways to build up pressure in advance. That process was made easier as the U.S. worked through the attribution problem, the issue of trying to prove who was at the other end of the attack. According to former U.S. official James Lewis, in 2007 the U.S. military could attribute about one-third of the attacks, but that doubled by 2013, partly by combining other forms of intelligence, like intercepted communications or human spies, with computer-based technical means. Resolving attribution with total certainty remains hard, but a bit like any detective inquiry, you can increasingly marshal enough evidence to make a convincing case, especially when attackers are sloppy and leave clues. You can also go after them. One of the simplest ways is to switch on the webcam of an attacker's computer so you can physically see them at work, spying on the spies. I've actually said to the Chinese at various points, "You know, you've got to get your hackers to dress better," says James Lewis, now of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. "I saw this one guy, he was wearing a wife-beater T-shirt. I was looking for the pizza boxes in the background." GCHQ and NSA staff would find themselves wading through data on hackers' computers, including pictures of pets and old family photos. But they would also find some more revealing images, such as the presumed hacker in the uniform of the Chinese PLA. One operation, codenamed Arrow Eclipse, by the NSA's own hackers, targeted the systems used by Chinese Byzantine Candor hackers. By gaining access to the billing and customer records, it was able to tie attacks to specific user accounts. These came from China's 3PLA. After the publicity blitz, Unit 61398 went quiet, but only for a time. They abandoned their technical infrastructure, but then simply built up a new one. In 2014, the U.S. Department of Justice took the unprecedented step of charging five members of PLA 61398 with hacking into a handful of U.S. companies, who were chosen out of a long list because they were not defense companies. The FBI issued Cyber's Most Wanted pictures of the hackers, who included Ugly Gorilla. In a deliberately provocative move, two were even pictured in their PLA uniform. It was the most direct link made between corporate espionage and the Chinese state. But will such public pressure work? Not everyone is sure. The reason goes back to the essential strategy guiding Chinese activity. There is something almost existential about the Chinese approach to this kind of cyber espionage, argues Nigel Inkster, a former deputy head of Britain's MI6 and a China watcher. "I think the perception in China is that they really, really need to move as quickly as possible across as broad a front as possible to acquire all the capabilities that would enable them to modernize and put themselves more on a par with a country like the United States." The U.S. has been trying to pressurize the Chinese state into clamping down on such activity by portraying it as illegitimate and unfair in both scale and whom it targets. I stand back in awe as a professional at the breadth, depth, sophistication, and persistence of the Chinese espionage effort against the United States of America. As a professional, it's awesome. I don't know how they handle all the data they steal, says former NSA Director Michael Hayden. We steal secrets too, I've already admitted to that, as does GCHQ, but we steal only those things that keep British or American subjects safe and free. We don't steal things to make Americans, or in GCHQ's case, British subjects, rich. The Chinese do, and they do it on a massive scale. That's the difference between what free people do in terms of signals intelligence and what the Chinese are doing. And what makes that so pernicious is that they are a powerful nation-state, not attacking a nation-state's telecommunications or IT infrastructure, but attacking private industries' IT infrastructure. That's an incredibly uneven playing field when the resources of a nation-state are massed against even a sophisticated company like Google or RSA. Some in the U.S. have compared Chinese activity to the piracy hundreds of years ago in which state-sponsored privateers raided the ships of opposing nations to steal their precious cargo. Eventually, that was deemed unacceptable behavior and states put a stop to it, pushing it to the margins. The hope is that public pressure, along with an internal Chinese trend towards greater central control from the new leader, Xi Jinping, might lead to a reduction in China's espionage activity. China sees the focus on commercial espionage as hypocritical when the U.S. itself spies so aggressively in cyberspace. It is a not completely new thing to obtain the technology secrets for learning from another country. It did exist even before cyberspace, argues General Xu Guangyu, formerly of the PLA. The espionage activities started more than 100 years ahead of the birth of cyberspace, so we don't need to give special attention to similar things in cyberspace. The key point is that the control power of cyberspace is too concentrated in the hands of the U.S., which makes cyberspace very unbalanced. James Lewis recalls attending a difficult meeting in China to discuss economic espionage. In the U.S., economic espionage is a crime, and military espionage is heroic, a Chinese military official told him. But in China, the line is not so clear. If Chinese economic espionage is supporting state-owned enterprises, and their growth is vital to preserving the country's domestic stability and international position, then does this count as national security? Samuel Slater, of course, was a hero in America for stealing industrial secrets, but a villain in Britain, and China today queries America's distinctions on acceptable versus unacceptable espionage. America essentially says that traditional espionage for national security is a free fire zone in which everyone can do anything. But a state attacking another country's companies is out of order. But in reality, there are no rules in espionage. There might be norms of behavior that come to be agreed on. For instance, in the Cold War, the KGB and CIA did not normally execute captured members of the other side's spy agency, but swap them. But who gets to decide what the norms are? In Washington and also London, there was another concern about China. As its industries grew, one company in particular sent shudders down the spines of some worried spies.